We will pick up now here with the discussion questions in 1 Peter chapter 4. And just by the way, these questions are for the purpose of summary. And if you will note it, going back to the third verse of 1 Peter chapter 4, where we're given the instructions that because or since Christ suffered for us in the flesh, we are to be as He is. 4, verse 3, we have spent enough of our past lifetime in doing the will of Gentiles. So here in question number 1, we are asked to contrast the will of the Gentiles with the behavior that the Holy Spirit requires of Christians. In order to contrast that, we would have to establish what is characteristically the will of the Gentiles and the practice of that will. How would we characterize that? It always happens. Everybody wants to talk, but nobody wants to talk first. Anybody? Yes, come. Okay, worldliness. Yeah, in fact, the term Gentile can be used in many ways, but the way in which it's typically used, and Peter does this, especially in his epistles, the way it's typically used as you're contrasting that with God and spirituality is by attributing worldliness to the Gentiles. When you look at the concept of the law and the chosen people of God being the Jew, then the opposite of that, it's kind of an opposite. You have righteousness, the opposite of righteousness is worldliness. The opposite of Jew is Gentile, and so it isn't uncommon that those things would be characterized in that way. Romans chapter 1 is a good example of this, when in describing the Gentiles and their practice, he talks about how they had given themselves, that they had forgotten the Creator and turned them through their pagan idolatries into that like a creature. And as such, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things that are not good. So when you're talking about the will of the Gentiles, we're talking characteristically worldliness. That's the point. Yes, Brad.
I've got a friend who's Jewish, and he called me a Gentile. And I said, I'm only a Gentile, but you. That's your term. It's like I'm a Gentile and a Muslim. And maybe one of them.
And the interesting thing, as it is used scripturally, the Apostle Paul indicates that now the Jew is one who is spiritually a Jew rather than physically, and whose circumcision is of the heart. So it is referencing the Christian. So the Jew today, having, that same concept is being used, the one that has that relationship with God as his chosen ones, is not the one who physically descends from Abraham, but rather the one who spiritually descends from Abraham. So the Gentile, you take him as a Jew, this individual is a Jew who called you a Gentile. When you're talking about in the mind of God, if he characteristically is an ungodly person, that is, he's an immoral or unrighteous, and you don't know if he is or not, but if that is the case, then with this illustration as it's used here, he would be the Gentile, you would be the Jew as a Christian. Kind of flipping the tables, because now it's not it doesn't matter what the fleshly relationship is. It's the spiritual relationship that is significant. Yes, ma'am.
When I read the next bit here in verse 3, I think
of the
all self.
Selfishness would be another indication. Of course, anytime an individual is engaging in sinful activity, there is an inherent selfishness that is there. I'm doing what I want to do rather than what God would have me to do. Good point. Yes,
in an expression that he uses another word, a Christian would be disciplined.
Okay, very good. Undisciplined versus disciplined. Very good. Yeah. And so when you look at that, the will of the Gentiles, and it is somewhat described here in the text, living in the flesh, living in accord with or for lusts, and then the characteristic of sins that are listed in verse 3, drunkenness, revelry, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. So there are some actual statements concerning what the will of the Gentiles are, as indicated in Scripture. Now, contrast that. Contrast, comparison. Comparison means those things that are like, contrast those things that are different. And really what you can do in actuality is look at that list. And you can say, okay, an individual living the rest of his time in the Spirit. Well, that would be one who is a Christian. Galatians chapter 5, the lust of the flesh warring against the fruit of the Spirit. So that would be a good opposite. The lust of men, those are illicit desires. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. And instead of an illicit desire, we can have licit desires. I actually don't know if the word licit is a word or not, but the opposite of illicit. So those that are legitimate desires, then those would be desiring the things of God, which would be, again, spiritual expressions, but also those things that are praiseworthy, those things that are noble, as Philippians 4 tells us. And then the will of God, of course, contrasted with the lust of men. Then when you get down into the third verse, and we're going to spend a little time in our second question looking at those things again, but specifically the will of the Gentiles, as described there in that third verse, we walk in lewdness, lust, drunkenness. Lewdness and lusts, again, those things that are illicit desires, but the concept of lewdness is in effect the creation of those illicit desires in others. If I am acting in a lewd or a lascivious way, then that creates in another individual an illicit desire or lust. And so you have both the giving and the receiving end of that as far as characteristically. So an individual who is the opposite of that, who is not lewd or lascivious, would be an individual who is modest, decorous in his demeanor, in his dress, and his actions. The one who does not lust is the one who refrains from those illicit desires. And then those three, drunkenness, revelries, drinking parties, have to do with the use and abuse of alcohol. And then idolatry, that is serving any master other than God. By the way, we have emphasized this in times past, but we'll do so again. Idolatry is not limited simply to bowing down before a graven image. Anytime there is a supplanting of God as the primary focus and purpose of our life, serving Him, and we instead put something above that, we exalt or elevate something else to a higher priority than God, then we are guilty of making it an idol. When we say covetousness is idolatry, as Paul did, the idea is there we have a desire that is so strong for something that is not ours and something we have no right to, that it basically becomes the center of our focus and the center of our life. And when an individual is so overcome with a desire for an object to where he covets it, then that object has taken first place in his heart and is supplanted God. And as a result of that, it's idolatry. Anything can be that way. Which is something that is certainly something we should consider, because we think in our day and time that idolatry is not a problem. You know, we don't get idols and stick them up on an altar in our home and bow down and worship these graven images, these objects of stone or wood. So we don't have a problem with idolatry. Well, yeah, we just basically put that aside and replace it with something else. But idolatry is something that most probably will be a problem with every generation, because there is always that desire to supplant God and not let Him be first in our lives. Yes.
As I said to you a few weeks back, I'm chuckling and said that I lust after money, because I pointed out that I had a coin collection, and now if that coin collection took up all my time, then it would become an idol.
That's right.
But as long as I keep it in moderation, everything's fine.
Moderation. Moderation and proper perspective. That's key in that regard. And that would be a characteristic of the Christian. It's wrong for us to say all things in moderation, because sin in moderation is still sin. But it is very possible, if we become immoderate in our pursuit of even legitimate things, that we can exalt them to the point of idolatry, that they can become sinful to us. All right. Yes?
Daniel, would you contrast between the
That's actually question two. So if we're finished with question one, anybody else with that? All right, let us go to the second question then, which is defining those three terms. And we've actually, of course, done that in the class once, but I do want to just spend a little bit of time. So let's, first of all, the term drunkenness, what does that mean? We'll kind of get the definition, but anybody?
Excess.
Okay, and the idea is there of excess. In fact, it comes from a Greek word, oino, which means wine, or and then flugia, which that sounds like a lot. Flugia of wine. And in fact, there is something to that. It is an overflow or a surplus. So when you, it's kind of a combination term in the Greek. So an overflow of wine, and there is a term that I didn't actually, vinolency, maybe. I'm not sure exactly how you pronounce it. It's a very, it's not a common term, but vinolency, maybe? Vinolency. I know what lency is, and like violence. But vino has reference to wine, so just consider that as another term. You might want to take the time to look that up. It's an English term, but that is where the alcohol is to a great extent. Okay, so very much so.
You're giving yourself to it.
Right, an excess of wine. And so with regard to that, and that's the King James Version renders it drunkenness as well. We're looking at the New King James with these three terms. That would be, and this is the picture that we remember in our original discussion. This is the guy that's sitting in the gutter, or the guy that's falling down because he's just completely overcome with it. Maybe an individual who we would consider in our day an alcoholic, especially if that's characteristic of his life. That's why a drunkard is considered in Scripture as far as the categories of sin is one who is not worthy of the kingdom of God. Okay, secondly, term is revelries. The word is komos, and it is referred to as revelings in the King James Version. Revelings or revelries. So what did we talk about in our class with regard to that one? Actually, it's again something that is indicative of social drinking in excess. In other words, there's still the concept of excess here. And as we were trying to look at the categorization, it would be something that's very, very typical of young people in drinking. And this is something that I've read about quite a bit with regard to studies. When you read about teenagers and college students, for example, on spring break or something along those lines, that the typical thing is binge drinking, keg parties, Mardi Gras, spring break, those kinds of things. That's the kind of stuff that comes out with regard to the idea of revelries or revelings. So what do you see in a situation like that? You see other types of sins. They become present. If you're in a bar, and everybody's drinking, and the inhibitions are being loosened and everything, you'll see other sins of immorality. It's in those kinds of situations that you'll find fights breaking out. Violence will sometimes accompany those things. You see the person sitting in the corner with a lampshade on his head. And we all think those kinds of things are funny, and it is. The picture is something that is amusing, but we're in a social situation, and people are going there to get plastered, or going there to get drunk. And so there's the second term. And again, the second term, as is the first, there is an indication there of excess that is inherent in the definition of the term. Yes.
As you said, I think it's defined in our day and age when people say, "What's the party?"
Yeah.
They don't mean let's go to dinner or to let's go get drunk and let's be loud and raucous and let's party.
Good. Raucous, that's a good term to describe that. So that
you can't do by yourself.
Do what?
And that's something you can't do by yourself.
Right. Yeah, there is that distinction between komos and oinophlusia with regard to drunkenness, is the fact there is a social aspect to this. It's something that you do with other people. Yes, sir.
Seems like it's always a lack of self-control, whether there's alcohol involved or not. When you go to sporting events, there's a lot of alcohol there also.
Yeah, in putting that, the term is a carousal and as if letting loose. I've always looked at that in the text because of the context. It's something that what the Apostle Peter is talking about, in effect, are various delineations of alcohol use. But you're right, there's nothing that's intrinsic in the term. I don't believe, with regard to alcohol use, and that it is that lack of self-control that is characterized, again, by violence or loss of inhibition and such. In our day and time, most commonly, that is present. But you can definitely sin by letting loose without ever putting any alcohol use. Plus, not only alcohol use, but also drug use would be another
thing.
Which is the opposite of temperance, which is something that should be characteristic of a Christian.
Yes,
and that's the thing that you'll, looking at the definitions of the term as they're understood in Scripture, the reveling is something, again, that would have to do more with something to excess. And again, it's something, this is one of these things where we're trying to make distinctions and all, but when you see it, you know. When you see those teenagers on spring break, that's a revelry, that's a carousing, an orgy. I'm not sure if that's a good translation of the term because, again, I don't know if there's anything intrinsic in the actual term with regard to sexuality, although it's something very common in that regard. But Brad gave up another example of there's no sexual connotation necessarily to people at the ballpark getting drunk and becoming obnoxious or getting in fights and things like that, but it would still be something that's a carousing or a letting go in that sense. But it certainly is involved in it or can be. And then the third one is the word potos, and drinking parties. It is banqueting. Now, when we say drinking parties, actually, I think that perhaps is a little bit of a misnomer. Not egregiously so, but when you think of a drinking party, or you hear that term, which is actually a very awkward term that we don't use in our language today, we say, okay, we're going to have a party for the purpose of drinking, and that's not what is referred to here. The literal word is, or the literal definition is, a drinking or a banquet. So it is, in effect, a party where alcohol is served. There's the difference. And so this is a situation where the term, we have a gradation here with regard to the terms, where you have the solitary falling down drunk, and we've got the carousals of Mardi Gras and spring break and things like that. And then you have individuals who get together, and this is where the sophistication that Dennis had kind of mentioned, getting together for the purpose of having an office party or a banquet of some type where drinks are served. Now that's characteristic of the Gentiles. And there are many things that are problematic with regard to that. The loss of influence would be an example. But this situation term is a term that is utilized as characteristic of the Gentiles and unworthy of the child of God. And it simply has reference to the social use of alcohol. It has no reference at all. There's nothing that's intrinsic in that term with regard to amount or excess. And that's why when we talk about social drinking, and let us make a distinction, let us understand what we're talking about with regard to social drinking, because there are some who would object to saying, well, you're saying it's wrong for me to sit in my house and drink a beer. Well, listen, if you don't tell me about it, I don't know about it. Okay, so that's not, I couldn't do it, don't think it's right, but that's a different thing. When you're drinking and I know about it, then you're harming your influence. You're a discouragement to me. You are acting like a Gentile in that regard, because that's what they do. And that's what this kind of use of alcohol is. We see it. We also recognize and see that it is something that leads to other problems. You take a parent, for example, who comes home and in front of their children, they have a beer or a mixed drink before you know, when they get home to relax and such. And the child sees that. What is the child going to do when the child is 18 with his friends? 13 with his friends, yeah. And I'd about to say, well, when they're legal, but they're not legal at 18, not either are they. But yeah, I mean, what happens? And you learn from example. A father's being a very bad influence on his children. And it has absolutely nothing to do with whether he gets drunk while he's sitting there or not. If you're sitting and you're in a social situation, whatever the social situation is, and you are drinking as a part of it, or present at those things where the drinking is there, and you're part of it, and enjoying it, and being a part of it, and all, then you're doing what the Gentiles do. And that's what I want y'all to get out of this. He says, we've spent enough of our past lifetime in doing the will of the Gentiles. Now, what about this situation? Verse 4. I'm reteaching what we've already taught, but I think it's worthy of just taking that time. So, in regard to these, they think it's strange that you don't run with them in the same flood of dissipation. If you refuse to be involved in those kinds of things, then what's going to happen? We're going to go out to this bar. We're going to go out and do this. And, well, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to be part of that. Why not? That's a big deal. And that's the view that they have about it. But it gets to the point where, and this is the thing, you know, with friends and okay, then if they're truly friends, then they're not going to object to the fact that you don't want to engage in those kinds of activities with them. But when I talk to young people about this, I say this quite often: stop doing what they want you to do and start doing what God wants you to do, and see how long you will be their friend. I think it's something that's a pretty valid point, that it's not going to take long before they say, you know, I don't want to be around them anymore. As Christians, our responsibility is to be salt and light. And I guarantee you, if you are with people who are characteristically worldly, and you are salt and light to them, one of two things is going to happen. Either you're going to be a good influence to them, bringing them out of worldliness so they repent, or else because they hate the light and love the darkness, you're going to be excluded and persecuted for your faith, or rejected. And when that happens, just see who truly is your friend. It's easy for people to like you if you're doing what they want you to do. Got hands going up there for you. Go ahead, Robert.
Well, I was just about to say what you said earlier, that there may be a lot of other, or several other folks in that crowd that kind of object to it, and why have the guys to stand up and say, I don't want to do this. This might be the catalyst to change their lives. You might not have to be actually preaching to them or teaching to them. They just find somebody they stand with instead of the crowd.
Good point.
I used to think when I was a teenager, when I got to be an adult, all this would be easier about the alcohol and stuff. There wouldn't be so many temptations. It took me a long time to learn that it's not easier unless you get rid of the people.
Yeah.
It's not age that changes. You learn to surround yourself with people who feel the same way you do. And then, of course, it's an easy thing. But if you stay with worldly people, it doesn't get easier as you get older. The motivation changes. They don't say, let's go get drunk. They say, but it's a business dinner, and you need to be there, and you need to be drinking because other people are drinking. And so it flips, and why you should do it, it doesn't change.
Yeah, that's and that's why we are told that one who makes himself a friend of the world, or is a friend of the world, makes himself an enemy of God. And if you serve God first, then eventually those problems seem to resolve themselves. It may cause some personal heartache as a result of it. Brad, did you have something?
We have a different thing. Bringing it up. My senior year in high school, my best friends, they didn't bring it up. Before the end of our senior year, they decided they were all right for the fall. So, three of them wound up over here and the place over here in Bigelow. And I think that a couple of fellows that were
Yes. Okay.
In these three categories from this representation, every one of those is about how release your inhibitions and that being more superior in different instances. But also the drunkenness around his breaking place can lead to a physical deterioration of the brain.
Right.
Very well.
Yeah, that's exactly. I mean, you're running into problems physically as well, certainly. But I do want to make that point that you stated with regard to the release of inhibitions. One of the principles, we're talking about the contrast here between the will of the Gentiles and those things that are righteous. One of the things that we're called to is self-control. Self-control. And I just want you to consider how you know, because people today, when you talk to them about drinking alcohol, and you object to the drinking of alcohol in those circumstances, they minimize it. It's not that big a deal. As long as it's done in moderation, it's not a big deal. And yet, with regard to pharmacology, alcohol releases inhibitions. It is a depressant. It relaxes. And what happens when that is the case in regard to those involvements, there are things that an individual would not normally do that he does. Now, we see it time and time again. Now, when it kicks in, I don't know exactly. I've heard and talked with Kendra a little bit about it, and I've heard this from others. You know, the very first drink with regard to the effect on driving. And police officers will tell you that, you know, the effect is immediate with regard to reflexes and various things. It's a matter of the more you drink, the more impaired you get, but from the first drink there is a percentage of impairment that's there. So the effect is there, even in moderation. And if we're called for self-control, and we all recognize and understand how difficult self-control is sometimes, then why would we ever engage in activity that lowers our ability to control ourselves, releases our inhibitions? The idea of being inhibited today, people say inhibition, you don't want to be inhibited. You want to be comfortable and you want to be relaxed. Well, inhibition means a limit, structure. And as Christians, we are called to be, in effect, inhibited. What do we inhibit ourselves from doing? Anything but simple. If we have some, whatever it may be, and again, the pharmacology, it doesn't matter whether it's alcohol or if it's some other kind of a drug. If we're taking things that interfere with our ability to control ourselves and our actions, then that's inherently problematic and dangerous and characteristic of the Gentiles. And things that we used to do but shouldn't do anymore. That's what Peter's saying there. Yes, Josh.
I personally think it kind of goes back to what you were saying earlier about sin just being selfish, each sin being selfish to some extent. And I appreciate you saying that, because last night at dinner, we went to a soft grass with my parents, and across the little section of dining room that we were in, there was a man who sat down with his family, his two young kids, his wife, and one of their sets of parents. And he was the only one there with anything alcoholic that I could tell. He had a Corona. Well, to my understanding, my own father, who drank beer before, where he tried beer once, he said it was disgusting. It was before he was a Christian. He said it is just quite disgusting. I mean, you even smell the stuff, and it's repulsive. So how a person can drink it means they just have to want to. Well, why do most people typically have a beer? They say, well, it's to take the edge off the day, loosen me up, help me up. Not so much think about my troubles. Well, if you're sitting down to dinner and you're drinking, what that tells me is you don't appreciate your family. to loosen yourself from, that you really can't be in their company properly unless you're loosening yourself up. And to me, that's rather selfish that you do that.
I've heard the term that alcohol is a social lubricant. And it often turns into a crutch where individuals cannot feel comfortable in a social situation without drinking, or it becomes a crutch in the sense of if you're going to be in a social situation, the drink is something that is going to be there. In other words, it accompanies it, and it certainly, again, can be problematic, leads to problems, but the idea of that selfishness is, as I was pointing out, ultimately the selfishness is with regard to God, because you're doing something that God tells you not to do, and you're doing your will. That's what selfishness is, doing what I want to do rather than what someone else would desire for me. Yes?
You're talking about inhibitions, loss of inhibitions and dangers, and I didn't become a Christian until I was 30 years old, so there's a lot of young years that I did things in a lot of places I shouldn't have been. One of them was a fraternity party, and there was a lot of drinking going on, and one of my friends had to stop from, he had a vodka bottle with the top broken off, so it was nothing but the bottom half of jagged glass, but he was trying to drink out of that vodka bottle with that pieces of glass probably falling down in there. He was going to swallow. And then when you talk about loss of inhibition, that's not just, you know, I mean, anybody with a liquor sense would know better than to do something like that if you're sober. But, yeah. But just put a jagged glass in your mouth.
Yeah, he had reached the point where common sense, or he didn't have a lick left.
Just totally gone. And that, I mean, if you're going to do that, just think of all the other things you can do. And you can see people hit on each other's girlfriends, and you know that's going to get
but boy, they were having a good time with it.
Yeah, but there's so many ways that your inhibitions lack of them. Inhibitions are a good thing.
Yeah,
it keeps you out of a lot of trouble.
Good point.
And when they're gone, there's just so many ways that you lose.
Good point, Nick.
Yeah, as you mentioned, we started on question two, it ties in question one there, and also Paul wrote to the Romans with a little different way in Romans 6. 19 to 21, where in 19 talks about the weakness of the flesh, potential members and slaves of uncleanness and lawlessness, and it says here leading to more lawlessness, and then in 20 talks about being slaves of sin, you're free in regard to righteousness, and in verse 21 there's a whole lot of people saying about their experiences of one another. What fruit did you have? Then the things which you are now ashamed for, the end of these things is death. Paul brings about being ashamed of all these things in verse 1 and the will of Gentiles and this here in question 2 about the problems and all that. So those of us that were raised in the church, we look back and think we're ashamed of them.
You know, that's an interesting point that you make, and one to just kind of keep in mind. I'd ask the young people to look at that verse, because we've already heard it several times, and you could probably go and look at those of us who have spent some years on this earth and you know, say, boy, there are a lot of things when I was young. You know, I was stupid when I was young, or things I did when I was young that I'm ashamed of or I regret. And this is the best thing that you can do, is listen to those people, find out what their regrets are, the stupid things they did, the things that they're ashamed of, and you don't do them. Why, wouldn't that be smart?
Just too young.
Wow! And so you get through your youth, and then you get when you're older, and you'll say, well, you know, if I would have done that, I would have been ashamed. If I would have done that, I would have regretted it. If I would have done that, that would have been stupid. But I didn't do it. and you would avoid an awful lot of regret and heartache by taking that view. Someone says, well, yeah, but I miss a lot of fun. Well, wait a second. They just said they regretted it. They were stupid things, things that caused them shame, caused them problems. And that's the way the devil works. The devil entices. And he puts it out there as being something that is to be desired. But it's an illicit desire that leads to dissolution. When we talked the other day about the singing from Colossians chapter 3, that we're to sing, and that gives us inspiration and encouragement. But those things that are the world, the excesses of the world, they lead to dissolution. And that indicates the concept of destruction, of decay, of problems that is a result of that. And that's what worldliness does. Yes, you have fun, but it's destructive. And the fun's not as great as what you might think. And it leads to heartache. So why do it? Why not have the righteous joy that comes from being a faithful child of God and engaging in righteous activities? Yes.
Alcohol doesn't make you act better in situations, but you think you do. And rarely does the person who has been drunk, the next thing go, wow, that was really bad. And if they do, they say, well, it was the alcohol. So they excuse themselves. They use alcohol to create the situation, then use the alcohol to excuse the situation. But it doesn't make people better in social situations. It does make some people think they're better.
Yeah. Good.
The fact is that people do self-medicate with alcohol. They use alcohol to cover feelings of inadequacy, insecurity, shyness, all sorts of reasons to self-medicate. And one other comment I want to make is what Brad said a while ago. He was not with those guys, and yet he was still caught up in the sense that people thought he should have been there because he was part of that group. And that's one thing young people don't take into account quite often is, you know, Paul told the Thessalonians in 1 Thessalonians 5:22, the same Paul parents did. I mean, you can say, well, I'm going to be a designated driver. I'm just going to make sure everybody gets home safe. But, in a sense, that sounds noble, except that everybody knows you're there. You're part of that group.
You're endorsing what they're doing.
That's right.
That's what you can't get out of is by being a part of it, whether you're actually involving yourself in the actual sin of drinking or getting drunk or whatever. It doesn't matter. It doesn't change the fact. They accept you as one of them because you're endorsing what they're doing. I mean, you're not going to sit there around the table and preach to them about their drunkenness. You're not going to be objecting to it. You're going to be laughing at their loss of inhibition rather than criticizing them, preaching to them. I mean, can you imagine someone? I'm going to be a designated driver, and you're sitting there at the table with them, and they're drinking, and you're telling them you're going to get drunk, and drinking this is a sin, and you ought not to be doing this, and you should be ashamed of yourselves. They're going to take it lost. And if you're not doing that, then you're endorsing what they're doing. And that's what Christians do. I mean, these individuals that are trying to defend themselves now. So I'm not doing it myself. No, but you're there, and you're endorsing it, and you're a part of it. And you can't get past that. And we need to recognize that. Amy, did you have something?
Romans 1:28 talks about how when they thought not to acknowledge God any longer, he gave them over to their depraved mind. And that's something that I try to instill in my children, you know, to remember when you go out there, you're dealing with the depraved, you know. And the saved should not act like the depraved. And if the saved does act like the depraved, no longer have any life or any tools or any ability
And to address that with what Josh just said, because Josh indicated, and again, you have the same mindset that I have. How could anyone ever do that? Why could they? But the fact is, people enjoy it. People, I guess they cultivate a taste. They want it. They enjoy it. They love to be around it. And so I'm not going to stand here and say that you're not going to have fun if you're worldly. Sure you will. Have a blast. I'll tell you that it's going to be destructive to your life. But even if you escape that, it's destructive to your spiritual welfare. But the fact is, just because it's fun is not an indication that it is righteous. Because if, as Amy says, you have a depraved mind, you no longer retain God in your knowledge, the debased or depraved mind is a mind that enjoys and involves themselves in those things. And, it's obvious. All you have to do is look at all those kids on spring break and see that they're having a blast. Now, the next morning they may look miserable, but that evening they're having a lot of fun. Debauchery and excess is fun, but it's destructive and will cause you to lose your soul. And those who are faithful Christians, they don't get any enjoyment out of that. And you're just that attitude of shame. Shame's a bad thing. That's what modern psychology will tell you, at least the attitudes that some secularists have about it. Shame, you have to get rid of shame. Wow. The Bible calls us to be shame-faced. I like that term. Or shame-faced. Wonderful memories. I can't remember what I did, but I can tell I was enjoying it. I wouldn't have known I did that, except there I am. Yeah, there's a lot of that exists as well. All right. Yes, Dennis. We'll just pick up with question number 3 next time and talk about 2 until we finish. Go ahead.
Here's the good thought in our text, verse 3 and 4. Like the point he's making is that these are things that we used to do when we became Christians.
Right.
Including the drinking part, too, though that might seem to be a little bit more innocent than the other things. He said, regarding these things, the training, you do not want them. The point they're being is, you don't need to find a way to do those things.
The distinction becomes very, very clear. As Christians, our responsibility is to stand against and speak against evil and sin. We do that. You expose the darkness. What happened to Jesus when he exposed the darkness? He was crucified as a result of it. We're no better than our master. And people who love the darkness hate the light. And so when we expose them, expose the action as sinful or unacceptable, then we will not be accepted as a result of that. And that should not cause us great consternation. If that upsets you or bothers you significantly, then that's simply an indication of a friendship with the world. And again, when you look at this, 1 Peter 3, or 1 Peter 4, he's saying, we did that enough, we don't do that anymore. But he's saying it to people who needed to hear that you're not supposed to be doing that anymore. So, I mean, there's probably was a need there, because there were some who were Christians who were still walking as the Gentiles. They were still engaging in things that were inappropriate, and there was an admonition that was being given here. So, there is such a thing as worldly-minded Christians. There is such a thing as Christians who have made themselves enemies of God by their friendship with the world. They're not faithful. They're not accepted of God. But that danger is there. Just because you become a Christian doesn't mean that all of a sudden everything is righteous and pure and you never do anything wrong anymore. There's that admonition continually. But it's something for us to keep in mind. That worldliness is something that is unacceptable to God. We'll pick up with question number 3 next time. Appreciate very much everyone's time, attention, and discussion, even though we didn't get far. We'll finish it up next week.